Hello, everybody, and welcome to this episode of the Thinking Commercially podcast, the business and commercial awareness podcast with me, Ben Triggs, and the wonderful Chris Stokes. In this month's episode, we discuss how ChatGPT could change the business world in the short term, the CIB and businesses lobbying government. What is shadow banking and why you should know about it? And finally, is a bank holiday good for the UK economy? All of this and more in this episode. Let's get started. Hi there, Chris. How are you this month?
Very well indeed, Ben. How are you?
Yeah, really well. Ticking along really nicely. As a custom with this podcast, the weather is got to be the first topic of conversation, and it is a very beautiful Tuesday morning when we're recording this, where I am. Really much looking forward to getting out there at lunch and having a bit of a walk, because it does look very picturesque. Yes, how have you been this month, Chris? What have you been up to? Anything interesting, anything new to report?
Not really. Like you, enjoying the spring weather, which has been lovely, and looking forward to this episode very much.
Yeah, great stuff. And with this episode, we're going to be discussing three key stories from the business world, but really focusing on the trends around them. If you've listened to it before, you'll really understand that what we want to do is get you thinking about the business world, not just knowing the kind of current affairs or the current stories that are going on at the moment. But I think, Chris, the first thing that we do need to talk about, and if you did listen to the previous episode, if you haven't, definitely go and listen to it. But the previous episode, we covered a story on EY, and we were discussing their proposed or potential breakup of EY, broadly speaking, along their sort of audit lines and their consulting lines. And we were talking a little bit about how tax might be split in two, or how they split tax as being one of the key challenges to this split. But there has been a bit of an update. And if you were reading the business headlines, you would have seen about 2 weeks ago, I believe, from the time of recording, EY decided that they weren't going to split their business. I thought we'd ask you a couple of questions, Chris, about that, so we can finish off that story for now, especially if people were listening to last episode. So, Chris, I guess the obvious question is, why did the split not happen?
Well, it's a good question, and I'm not sure we'll ever know the reasons. The thing about these things is that organizations like EY don't like to make things public until they know for sure that something's going to happen. But I think when you're a partnership as large as that, it's very difficult to keep it quiet. And although the media have made a big thing of this, I think if you were inside EY, you wouldn't actually think it's as dramatic as all that. And a couple of things worth saying. These things are extremely costly. A figure that had been bandied about was $100 million. And I'm not sure whether that's actual money that they would be spending on rebranding, for example, or whether that's the money they lost in lost time, which could have generated fees. So these things are very costly. And also, they can lead to huge back office issues, because you're basically trying to create two businesses and two brands where previously there was one. And I suspect what they realized was that it was so complicated splitting the business up that in the end, you're better off as part of one big thing than being part of one of two smaller ones.
I guess the second part of it is, what happens now? So they've decided not to split. Is it go back to business as usual, how they were?
I think so, absolutely. Because one of the things that will have come out from the discussion is they will have recognized the benefits of being an integrated business. Well, when you go through these sort of internal discussions about should we split or not, should we acquire another business or not, it really focuses your mind on your strategy. And I think they will emerge from this actually with a much greater sense of the advantages that they've got at being an integrated business. And of course, there's a short-term benefit, because these things take up so much internal management time that partners' eyes are taken off the ball of doing client work, keeping clients happy, and winning more clients. So actually, I think there will be a short-term fillip, as it were, benefit, as it were, to their business as everybody gets back to the day job.
Great stuff, Chris. Thank you so much for giving your insights on it. We thought worth covering off, given we spoke about it last time and there had been a major update on the story since our last episode. But we have got three brand new stories and one very fun story at the end as well to cover this time. So we'll crack on with those. Our first story of this episode is about ChatGPT and how it's going to change the business world. You would be living under a rock if you haven't seen all of the headlines. You probably would even be living under a rock if you haven't even used it or even given it a try to ask ChatGPT a question, or even maybe even ask it to do an essay or a piece of written work, which has been in the press quite a lot recently. But yes, this is the new tool that's been worked on over a number of years, but kind of gained prominence recently as a new AI generated content tool, which has been used more and more over the last few months, and it's got a lot of people talking about its potential outputs in the business world, but also in wider society. And there is a lot of positivity around this, with people suggesting how it could improve efficiency, do lots of manual tasks better with more accuracy, and change certain sectors for the better. However, it has also been met with a lot of worries as well. And actually, some leading figures have suggested it's moving maybe a little bit too quick. I think Elon Musk, in fact, asked for or suggested a 6-month break to realize what's going on, build out regulation, and work out the best usages for this technology. So you've kind of got this battle between people that go, well, this is going to have so much benefit, let's move as quick as possible, as technology typically does, but also people that see the potential downsides of AI, and just making sure that we're careful as a society, as humanity, in the uses of this. For this time, Chris, I think we need to really focus in on how it's going to impact business, and I really want to do it in the short term. You see a lot of predictions about how it's going to change the world in the next 20, 30 years and what's going to happen. But I think for our listeners, what will be most useful is what is going on right now and what's going to happen in the next couple of years. So, Chris, the first question I want to ask you is, why is ChatGPT so revolutionary or not for the business world?
Well, I think the first thing with this, and indeed it's the first thing that one has to think about in relation to any topic, is what are we actually talking about here? GPT stands for Generative Pre-trained Transformer, and it's a subset, as far as I can make out, of something called LLM, Large Language Models. And what's interesting about large language models is that we tend to think of computerization or automation as a numerical thing. And this isn't. This is about language. So LLMs are about language, and they're about detecting patterns in language, which is why the first applications are to things like word search, word patterns, putting words together. And in addition, it's about what used to be called machine learning. So, in other words, a computer that can make itself smarter by learning for itself through the use of pattern deduction. So, a typical application is a computer that can learn to play chess and get better at chess as it becomes aware of the changing patterns of the game. So, that's what we're dealing with. And I think that's why it helps us vector in on which industries are most likely to be affected. And they are surprisingly creative industries like writing, journalism, advertising, PR. I mean, AI has also been used for photography. Recently, a photographer won an award for a picture which they then admitted had been generated by AI, and they'd done it as an experiment. And I've read stories that, for example, video game designers in China say that they're now being put out of work because clients are not coming to them to devise video games, but they're using AI. So I think what's unusual about this technological progression is that it's more likely to hit professional services than previous ones. Previous ones were, for instance, use of robots in factories. They were regarded as automating manufacturing processes. As far as I can tell, this is much more likely to affect what you and I and our listeners would call professional services. So things like legal research, drafting documents and opinions, applying laws and regulations, that sort of thing.
I think also something that I was reading about was sort of in the medical industry and AI, and maybe not ChatGPT specifically, but more AI being able to detect patterns and being better at diagnosing patients than humans. And kind of thinking about that from this point, when you're looking at sort of doctors and people training, obviously what would be the role of doctors? Obviously there'll be that human element to it, but what role will AI play in assisting them being able to better diagnose patients, find better treatments, do better drug research as well, which I think for most people feels like a massive, overwhelmingly positive thing in the kind of medical industries. However, if you're looking to be, or you are a budding content creator, your creative social media person, whatever it might be, I think it can be met with quite a lot of worry, because you've got something which you might be good at, but there is the potential that over the next few years that AI machines could be relied on a lot more than sort of the human touch for that sort of creativity. With that, Chris, and maybe drawing on your kind of experience of seeing sort of technological advances over your career, what would be your message to those that maybe are slightly worried about the impact of AI on a potential career path?
A research paper has been produced by the University of Pennsylvania in conjunction with OpenAI, which made the ChatGPT app, and AI Research, looking at the possible impact on employment of AI. And they make a number of really good points. One is that all technologies, and they talk about steam, for example, and printing, require three things. They've got to have widespread proliferation, which I think AI will have, continuous improvement, and also complementary innovation to your particular industry. And one of the problems at the moment with AI is, can you actually trust its output? So in the world of journalism, AI may be able to produce stories, but how much depth are these stories going to have? And I don't know whether you remember this, but I'm reminded of the film Polar Express. And the thing about Polar Express is that it's a children's film, and it was completely animated, but based on human actors. And actually, it was quite creepy to watch, because it was almost as if the technology had almost got the human touch, but not quite. And so I think with these things, there is that last bit of development that is the hardest to accomplish. And applying this to the profession I know, law, it's no good for an AI provider to say to me, well, this search is going to be 90% correct, because in law, that just doesn't cut it. It's got to be 100% correct. So first of all, I think what people who are concerned about this could do is, first of all, just keep abreast of it. Because I think being aware of these developments, you start to get ideas about how you can adapt to them. And secondly, I don't think that they will sound the death knell for lawyers, accountants, research analysts, and so on, because at the heart of what professional services do, there is that human element. You can automate as much as you like, but at the heart of it, there is client relationship management. And so long as the world is run by humans rather than machines, clients are going to be people. And you need to be able to develop those skills, those interpersonal skills, which actually I think social media tend to militate against. So an absolutely brilliant lawyer once said to me, Chris, there are only two ways to succeed. One is to be a legal genius, which by definition, most of us can't be. But the other is just be really good with clients. And the good thing about being really good with clients is you don't even have to be very smart to be able to do that. And I think he's absolutely right. So developing those skills which enable you to interact with other people, I think, is crucial. But one of the things that I think will happen is that as more of the technical end of what we do gets automated, there will be a need for people to explain what these things mean to other people. As the world gets more complicated, clients don't really want to know the detail of the complication. What they want to know is, what does this mean for me and my business? And I don't think that is going to change very much over the next few decades.
I also think it could make jobs more interesting. I think technology, broadly speaking, has. You don't have so many jobs which are data entry, which maybe 30, 40 years ago, you'd have jobs which were very much pure data entry, which were most people would consider fairly dull. Whereas, as Chris sort of said, all the data entry is done, some of the analysis is done, and it's actually someone mastering the technology, interpreting the data and explaining it to someone else. So it actually becomes maybe a slightly more exciting job, I would say. And I think we can always look at the implications of technology, and we can always think to ourselves, oh, well, you know, with this technology coming in, how am I going to make my money? How am I going to carve out my skills, carve out my niche? But we've been, well, broadly speaking, since the Industrial Revolution, technology has moved at a rapid pace, and people have had those sort of worries. And each time it evolves, and jobs just change rather than completely disappearing.
And I think one interesting thing that came out of this Penn University paper, surprisingly, I thought, they concluded that fund managers wouldn't be affected. And when you think about this, you think, well, hang on a minute, what fund managers do is invest money. And you would have thought that you can bring a huge amount of computing power to bear on the financial markets to help you invest more successfully. But the thing is that a world like finance, which you would have thought could be AI'd completely, it can't be. Otherwise, we would have millionaire investors all over the place. And what people are beginning to understand now is that with finance, there's a thing called behavioral finance, which basically says the markets are quite irrational and driven by the fact that they're populated by people. So I thought it was very interesting that a profession that you might have thought would be very badly affected has been excluded. And I come back to, and this may be a bit facile, but even though computers can do any sort of incredible calculation that you want with numbers, we still have mathematicians. So they haven't been put out of work. So I think this idea that AI is going to put swathes of professionals out of work, I think at the moment is a bit far-fetched.
Chris, a question that I wanted to ask, and this is actually borne out from the interviews in sort of America that Mark Zuckerberg has had to go through, and a few other kind of big tech companies presidents or CEOs have had to go through, where it's quite clear the kind of Congress or the lawmakers don't really understand the technology, and therefore when they're trying to make rules on it and regulations, they've struggled. I think anyone that watched any of the clips from Meta, or what was Facebook then's sort of inquiry, felt that probably the people asking the questions were probably the wrong people to be asking the questions about data privacy and various topics like that. Is there a feeling that maybe technology moves too quickly now, and this is a key example of it in AI, that means that regulators and lawmakers are struggling to keep up with the change, struggling to understand it, and that's where potentially we could run into problems, both in the business world and, I guess, wider society?
It's a very good point. And in fact, one of our latest stories is going to touch on this, the interface between business and lawmakers. I think sometimes we have rather elevated expectations of what lawmakers should know. They are by nature generalists, they're policymakers, they work at a level of abstraction, and it is quite difficult for them to get to grips with the detail of, for example, changes in technology. I mean, somebody like Mark Zuckerberg, he is so much in the weeds of what he does that it's probably quite difficult to understand exactly what he is saying unless you too are a technologist. So I think regulators always tend to be a step or two behind innovation. But I think what has changed is that they now know this. I think that what has happened over the last 20 years with the emergence of these big technology platforms is that regulators realized that they were not paying enough attention early on. And of course, the great thing is that as regulators necessarily get younger, you know, as the next generation steps into those sort of roles, they are much more aware of the impact of technology than previous generations were. So yes, regulators will always be a step or two behind, but I think that's quite natural. But I think they are much more aware than they were before of how pervasive these technological innovations are going to be.
Amazing. And one final question. It's more of a yes or no. Do you think we need, as some have subscribed to, a bit of a pause and don't develop the technology maybe for 6 to 12 months to let regulators and others catch up to make sure we know what we're doing with this very powerful technology? Or do you think we should be pushing on and letting the advances happen as quickly as possible?
Well, my quick answer is it's a nice idea, but the toothpaste is already out of the tube.
Excellent. We'll leave that there. Our next story this week is all about business lobbies, the influence they have on government, and the role that they have in the business world. We've actually had a few questions this week about the CIB specifically. And actually, I think this is largely due with the kind of the shocking accusations that have been leveled against them. And, you know, a lot of people talking about sort of the sort of toxic culture within that organization. But a lot of the questions we've had are about what actually it does generally and why it's useful, why it's in existence, and especially after they announced taking a break from activities to deal with them internally, the kind of the struggles and the challenges that they're having internally, and those kind of accusations have been leveled amongst sort of senior members of staff. For this episode, being obviously a business podcast, we want to answer those questions and focus on business lobbying and the role of that. That's the kind of the goal, to hopefully give you a bit more understanding of around the kind of story that may be in the media at the moment. So, Chris, what is the role of business groups in the economy? Why do they exist, basically?
Well, you'd be forgiven for not having heard of the CBI or any other trade associations, but before now, because they only really interact with the media when they're asked to give expert comment on things to do with business. So CBI, what does it mean? Confederation of British Industry. It's a trade association for business. There are others that are well known. There's the IOD, the Institute of Directors, which anybody who's running a business and is a director can join. And then also there are chambers of commerce. Chambers of commerce aren't written about very much, but they're really important because they work at a local and national level. And also they work at an international level. And they're really useful, particularly for SMEs. So if you're beginning to export abroad, you'll get in touch with your local Chamber of Commerce, and they'll put you in touch with the UK Chamber of Commerce in the country that you want to export to, and they can give you an awful lot of help. How these trade associations is funded is they're essentially not for profit, and they rely on members' fees. And without sounding too much like a lecturer, just say, what is it they actually do? I think they have two roles. As Ben, you said, one is external liaising with government, lobbying, which we'll get into. And then they also play a really important internal role for industry in general. They provide training, they can advise on regulation, health and safety issues, they can establish common best practice and common standards. So if I'm an entrepreneur, I've set up an SME, I'm doing really well, but I'm beginning to get out of my depth in terms of the regulations I need to be aware of, how to build my business, then going to a trade association can be a really useful source of very, very helpful information and practical advice from others who've done it before me. And the last thing to say is the one thing they cannot discuss, and this is absolutely crucial, is they cannot discuss pricing, because any discussion of how much you charge for your goods or services is immediately anti-competitive and can get you into an awful lot of trouble very, very quickly.
Yeah, that was a really good summary of them. I wanted to focus a bit more on the lobbying point of view. Obviously, talked about the training and the industry standards, but I think the lobbying perspective is quite important because A, it's huge industry. There's a lot of people there that are working on behalf of business, both internally in some of the big businesses, and then part of these groups that are aiming to influence government legislation, decisions, what's discussed, and everything like this. Chris, I think as soon as you hear the word lobbying, sometimes I think it can be seen as quite a negative thing, that it's sort of the dark arts, it's a little bit shady. But could you give me some examples maybe where potentially there is a positive output, or actually do you agree with the people that suggest that it is a bit shady?
I don't, but it's because I've spent some time studying it. Lobbying is very interesting because it really developed in the States, where it is absolutely standard practice for business to talk to government. Their view is, well, if government is going to regulate in a way that affects us, we need to talk to them. And obviously, government officials know that lobbyists are trying to put the best spin they can on what they're saying. But actually, I think lobbying can provide a really useful service because what I've learned over my life is that politicians are expected to be knowledgeable about all sorts of things to a level of detail, which, unless they've worked in a particular industry before, they're simply not going to have that knowledge. And government tries not to waste money, so they don't spend money necessarily on educating themselves about these things. What they do is they talk to people, and it's much better that business talks to government and government talks to business than that they don't. And I think both sides have reached a level of sophistication. The government knows when business is trying to pull a fast one. And from the business's side, it would be very easy for very large companies to dominate the discussion. So the SMEs that I've mentioned, where would they appear in this? Because they don't have the resources to lobby government. So by being part of a trade association, which does, the trade association will be talking on behalf of all of its members, not just the biggest who could lobby on their own because they've got the resources. And that in turn makes what they say to government more credible, because it's not just the biggest businesses in a sector that are putting forward their own self-serving point of view. This is a particular sector as a whole that is presenting to government the possible impact of what it's proposing to do. And these discussions are going on all the time. So a figure I've mentioned before, Tim Martin at Wetherspoons, he's been on at government for a long time about levelling up the impact of VAT as between pubs and supermarkets. And in the last budget, Jeremy Hunt moved towards that, which I think was a reflection of what Tim Martin and others have been saying. And then most recently, in terms of taxes on energy windfall profits, again, the energy sector has been talking to government about the energy profits levy and saying if you impose a blanket tax on all energy providers, then you're going to adversely affect renewables, whereas it should be a tax on windfall profits, which have mainly benefited the oil industry. So I think these discussions are going on all the time, and I think they are useful.
I completely agree with you, Chris, but I'm going to push back slightly because if you type into Google businesses lobbying government, a lot, especially written in The Guardian, to be fair, but a lot of headlines will come up around the, I guess, revolving door sort of phraseology is used, that basically, you can have people that are previously working in government and then they move into a role in business, which influences government, and vice versa, really, people in business going into government. And there is a worry, I would say, that businesses, through influencing government, potentially through payments made in certain to certain groups and certain things like that, are potentially having too much of an impact. What are your kind of thoughts around that?
Well, it's a bit like our discussion of AI. I think we learn as we go along, and I'm a reader of Private Eye, and if you want to get any sort of handle on the sort of lobbying that shouldn't be encouraged, then Private Eye is really good at exposing it. And of course, the more these things are exposed, the more people realize that you really shouldn't be doing them. So I wouldn't say that it's perfect, but I think we're in a much better place than we used to be 10 or 15 years ago.
I think obviously now everything is on record, like emails and everything like that. That kind of helps. Transparency has definitely increased a lot. Whereas obviously, maybe not 15 years ago, but 40 years ago, 50 years ago, everything was face to face. Everything was, over drinks, lunch, over a meeting table, which obviously nowadays most things are kind of recorded, which does bring a level of transparency, which is probably good for a sector like lobbying, as well as also talking about regulation. Regulation has improved, and I guess as we talk about regulators have caught up, they've seen the potential problems. There's been numerous examples which have been exposed, and having a kind of a counterbalance like the Private Eye against government and big businesses is quite important in that. And hopefully we get to a place where things are done fairly, and actually lobbyists can be a better source of information rather than an overbearing influencer across government policy. One final question: whatever industry, the graduates, students listening to this podcast go into, there will be an industry body that are related to that sector. Would you encourage people to get involved with it, or at least read what materials they're putting out? Is it something, do you think, is important for graduates in the modern business world to be associated with in any way?
Absolutely. And one of the good things about this story, I think, is that it enables us to focus on the numerous industry-specific bodies there are out there. So just a few examples: the British Retail Consortium, obviously for high street retailers, the British Property Federation for commercial property owners, the National Association of Pension Funds, the NAPF, and the Association of British Insurers, who represent institutional investors. And I mentioned Tim Martin at Wetherspoons, the British Beer and Pubs Association. These are really useful bodies. They have an enormous amount of industry-specific knowledge. And when you're starting out in your profession, if you start to specialize by sector, these are bodies that it is well worth getting to know. You'll learn a lot from talking to people about a particular industry, and they themselves they welcome input from lawyers and accountants and management consultants who are familiar with their industry. So I definitely think that it's well worth over time building a network amongst others who belong to those industry-specific bodies.
Fantastic. Sounds great. We'll leave it there for this week. Our third story of this month's episode is about shadow banking and why it is important. And Chris, this is one that you suggested for us to cover. I'm going to be honest with our listeners and say I didn't know a huge amount about it, but I have done a significant amount of reading over the last couple of days to try and catch up on it and hopefully give some opinions. But I think Chris, as the expert, as the person that wanted to talk it through, it would be great if you could give us a bit of an introduction into what shadow banking is and why our listeners should be engaged with it or interested in it.
Well, as with a lot of things that we talk about, Ben, I wanted to discuss this because I hate coming across terms that I think people will find confusing, terms that are then used by others to kind of exclude them from the discussion. Shadow banking is a term. It's topical at the moment because you remember we had the banking crisis of a few weeks ago with SVB in Silicon Valley and Credit Suisse in Switzerland either going bust or being rescued. And the optimist said, well, that just shows that banks are generally in a much better place than they were in 2008. But the pessimists are saying that actually the issues that caused those particular failures haven't really gone away. And in fact, they're going to pop up next in the shadow banking world. So question is, what is shadow banking? Just very quickly to understand this, and it's also sometimes called secondary banking. Not all loans come from banks. So a bank is something that takes in deposits from depositors and lends that money out again. But there are an awful lot of businesses that extend credit without actually taking in deposits. So just by way of example, buy now, pay later, car finance, mortgage loans are often not provided directly by banks. Finance companies that are used by SMEs in areas such as trade finance, expertise in areas such as ship and aircraft finance, and also insurance companies, they can get exposure to particular sectors through credit default swaps. So these are known as shadow banks because they're effectively extending credit, but they don't take deposits.
So this might be a slightly stupid question, but where are they getting the money to lend them?
I love questions like that because they're not stupid questions at all. Yeah, if they're not taking in deposits, where on earth do they get this money from? And the answer is they get the money from what's called the wholesale banking market. And again, this might seem rather counterintuitive, but actually banks spend a lot of time lending money to each other in what's called the wholesale banking market. And those that they lend to are often secondary banks or shadow banks. And the reason why pessimists think that there may be a crisis in shadow banking is because real banks, those that are taking in deposits and lending, are beginning to close down their lending. And they're doing that for the very reasons that SVB ended up in trouble, because they hold a lot of government bonds as part of their regulatory capital. And those bonds have gone down in value as interest rates have gone up. And so they're beginning to think, well, if our regulatory capital is decreasing, we shouldn't be lending as much as we have done. And of course, the first to suffer from this will be shadow banks that are entirely dependent on the wholesale banking market for finance.
And just to sort of clarify on this, when we talk about shadow banks, I think that has the kind of connotation that it's in the shadows. It's a bit shady, I guess. Whereas actually, this isn't necessarily that at all. It's kind of legitimate lending of money. It's just that at the moment, with increased interest rates, potentially there could be problems with them, with the kind of wider economy, especially if they're lending money at a certain rate and then they're having to borrow money at a higher rate when interest rates have kind of gone up. One of the things that I've sort of reading through was around the idea that banks were maybe able to lend less after the 2008-2009 financial crisis. Regulation basically increased, and therefore shadow banking allowed money to kind of flow into the system, into the economy, which a lot of people point to as being a very positive thing. Money's needed to flow through the economy for it to grow, basically, and for companies to get finance and people to buy things, very much so. So if it's seen as potentially a good thing, what are the kind of negatives at the moment, would you say?
Well, just to go back to what you were saying, Ben, I absolutely agree. I don't actually like the term shadow banking. I much prefer the term secondary banking, because it suggests that it's banking at one remove. And providers of secondary banking services, that doesn't mean to say that they're kind of quasi-banks or they don't really know what they're doing. If, for example, you're in the motor finance business, you've got a much better understanding of the motor finance market. Often that's provisional finance for SMEs to fund vans and trucks. You'll have a much better knowledge of that sector and the borrowers in it and their credit standing than a more generalized retail bank would have. So I absolutely agree with you. I don't like the implication that shadow banking is somehow a bad thing. I think what is interesting, though, and this is where the term is possibly more useful, the question is, to what extent are secondary banks regulated by bank regulators. And that's, if you like, where the issue lies, because if they're not deposit taking institutions, they could well fall outside standard banking regulation. And the reason why it is an issue is because if the wholesale banking market is becoming less open to secondary banks because of the increase in interest rates, then that could shut off a lot of potential funding, for example, for SMEs. And one of the, if you like, one of the coincidences is that banks reducing their lending is actually going to help control inflation. So in that sense, it will help central banks that are trying to put a cap on inflation at the moment.
So in some ways, you're suggesting that shadow banking is a positive thing, and actually it not being as relied on by the central banks will cause problems, as you say, for financing businesses and driving the economy forward. But I guess on the flip side, obviously, the more money that goes into the system, that is inflationary. So even though per se shadow banking isn't causing inflation, it could be a way by cutting it back to solve some of the challenges that we might have been at the moment.
That's absolutely right. And I think that the one kind of area of concern is central bankers saying, oh, our banks are much better regulated and much more heavily capitalized than they were in 2008. And so being slightly complacent about this, when in actual fact, the secondary banking market could be much more exposed to these kind of underground tremors, as it were, in the financial markets than central bankers might either think or, secondly, have much control over. That I think is the issue.
Well, we'll leave it there, and hopefully that's a new term for you. Hopefully you can now read a little bit more about it, and when you're thinking about how businesses are being financed, you can think about whether it's from a central bank or potentially a secondary bank with this idea of shadow banking. And as I say, hopefully that fits into your wider knowledge of the plumbing of the UK economy. We are recording this episode at the end of April. So we have just come off the back of two bank holidays over the Easter Friday and Easter Monday. And we are in the very fortunate position that we are on the cusp of two Mondays consecutively being off because of the May Day bank holiday and then the King's coronation. Last year, we also had two extra bank holidays for the Platinum Jubilee of the Queen and then the Queen's funeral as well. So over the last year or so, we've had a wealth of bank holidays, and it always raises the question of, as Britain, we should have more bank holidays. And then it also raises the counter argument that it costs the economy quite a lot to have a bank holiday. So maybe we should not be quite as enthusiastic and have the amount that we already have, which I believe is 8 in the year. Obviously, this year it will be 9 unless anything else happens that causes a bank holiday later in the year. But typically it is 8. It's one of those things where it doesn't feel like much of a commercial awareness story. But if you think about it, the arguments are all around the sort of business impact. Everyone talks about the kind of cultural and historical ideas at first and goes, well, we should, you know, be proud of this, proud of that, we should have bank holiday there. But then it always ties back to the business outputs and whether it will have an impact on the economy. It is believed, the government said a couple of years back, that it costs the economy 1.36 billion each bank holiday we had. A group that was led by PwC, or PwC Research, commissioned a piece which suggested it was actually £831 million that it cost the UK economy, and the government had got their figures wrong. So there's some serious research going on about this. But Chris, as our fun story of the week, do you think we should have more bank holidays each year, both from an economic standpoint or even a cultural standpoint?
Well, we've mentioned private eye, so I think we can balance that out by mentioning a publication called Investors Chronicle. And according to them, the Romans had 135 feast days a year. And they reckon the medieval peasants worked for half the year only. And as you said, we've got just eight. So maybe we need more. But I think I've got a couple of issues with it. The first is the name, because in the old days, when bank holidays were introduced and people didn't really take much holiday at all, these holidays occurred because banks were closed and so business couldn't take place. So I think still calling them bank holidays seems a bit odd. And because we're in a world of much more flexible working patterns, which I think is all to the good, it kind of doesn't seem quite so relevant that on a particular day, which actually, depending on your working pattern, may be a day that you would be not in the office anyway. You kind of feel penalized if that's a bank holiday and you're not getting it. So I'm not convinced about it. And the other thing, looking at these figures, what one estimate for the cost of the Platinum Jubilee last year was 2.5 billion. But then others say that what actually happens is not lost productivity, but displaced productivity, that the work that you would otherwise have done on a bank holiday, you do it other times of the week. So I'm not completely convinced of that. And the final thing I'd say is that obviously businesses generally may be closed, but retail sales tend to be up because high street shops stay open, and that they're up, it's generally thought about 15%. And of course, hospitality is up about 20% as against a normal weekend. But maybe because the businesses that do benefit are very much traditional businesses in our country, like gardening and DIY, maybe we should keep them after all, because it kind of reinforces the sort of people that we are.
I also think after, you know, 3 years, especially with the pandemic as well, the industries that were impacted significantly were tourism, retail, leisure, and typically they do very well out of bank holidays. I think the Center of Economics and Business Research found that we would spend an extra 500 million across a bank holiday, and that is largely on that kind of retail, tourism, leisure kind of industries, which I think are probably in need of a bit of a boost as well. And I think we have seen a lot of our favorite local pubs, a lot of potential attractions struggling over the last years, or even closing over the last few years. So I think there is, I guess, an element of balancing out, which is quite nice to see some industries doing better, whereas obviously for other industries, it's kind of having a day where nothing is happening. Chris?
And one other thing, one of our biggest exports is heritage. We attract a huge number of tourists to this country, and there are arguments over whether the coronation is a good thing or not. But one of the arguments in favor of it is the impact on tourism. Mm. So things that we take for granted in this country, which visitors don't, are things that actually are revenue earners for us. And so the traditional bank holiday may be that sort of an earner, because tourists who come to this country, they might coincide their trip with a bank holiday, knowing that there will be other things available to them.
Yeah, I was actually listening a couple of days ago to, I think the group is called Republic, but I could be wrong. But obviously, by the name that I've just suggested, it's pretty clear what they're looking for. They're pretty against having a monarchy in place. And I think one of the key arguments is, I guess, the political space, which actually they don't have a huge amount of influence, or they don't have any influence. It's just ceremonial. But the other thing, which is the main argument against it, is the cost of having a royal family that's coming out of the sort of taxpayers' money quite often. But I always in those arguments, they sometimes fail, I believe, to actually think about how much money it's bringing in. And sometimes that's actually quite difficult to quantify, because from abroad, the feeling of the UK could be slightly different because of the monarchy. The potential want for someone to come and visit the UK because of the history, and within that, the kind of monarchy, it's quite difficult, as I say, to quantify that. And it is one of those sort of arguments when it's becoming an economic argument, maybe the kind of argument's in the wrong place anyway, but it definitely comes down to that. And I think it's quite interesting, that sort of debate, which depending on which side you are on whether you believe it should be abolished or whether it should be in place, I think it always comes down to that business element as well. And for myself, I broadly sit on the fence on it, but always quite interested of the economic arguments being left out and kept in, depending on your point of view, which I think is talking maybe a little bit about lobbying earlier as well. Those lobbyists potentially leaving in the statistics and the economic arguments, which kind of suit their cause rather than the wider picture. It's quite interesting to see in this as well. Another point on bank holidays that I want to raise, I now lead Bright Network's kind of Germany business unit. And so now I've got a team in Germany, across Berlin, and in northwest Germany as well. And actually, they're quite regional when it comes to their bank holidays. But typically, it depends on the region how many more, but they will have more bank holidays than the UK. But if the day that they're celebrating falls on a weekend, including Christmas, they don't get the extra day. So obviously, as you'll be aware, in the UK, if you if the bank holiday day, let's say it's Christmas, falls on a weekend, you get the extra Monday or Tuesday off, depending on where it's falls. The same with New Year's Eve, but it doesn't happen in Germany. So even though it might seem that other countries have more bank holidays, they don't necessarily always get them as well. I feel that if we had bank holidays that fell on Saturdays and Sundays and we weren't given the extra days, I think a lot of people would be very miffed and very angry in the UK. So maybe our system isn't as bad as it seems. But I think the debate will continue on. It actually may not continue on quite as much if we start looking at sort of 4-day weeks, and potentially more people have 4-day weeks. The need for a bank holiday, as Chris talked about earlier, might actually decrease quite significantly. And actually, with flexible working, sort of bank holidays might be a nice thing to have, but the need for one or two more may be completely redundant. But anyway, whatever you're doing over the next couple of weekends, we hope you have a fantastic time. Hopefully, you really enjoy them. If you're a student, you may not even realize that it's a bank holiday. I remember studying history with 8 hours contact time a week, not really being aware whether it was a bank holiday or not, because I was only in lectures for about 2 or 3 days a week. But especially if you're in the working world, working away, hopefully you are able to get some time off. And hopefully, as we started with, the weather is fantastic as well. Chris, that's everything for this episode. Did you have any final thoughts on everything? Nope, we'll
No,
leave it there.
that's all for me.
Perfect. And just a quick reminder, the next episode will be a question-only episode. You might remember, I think it was in February, but it might have been January. But anyway, earlier this year, we did a episode dedicated to all of your questions. We get questions in, like we did with the CBI this month. We get lots of questions in, and we don't get a chance to get through all of them by covering only 3 or 4 stories each month. So what we'll do is we will pick 12 to 15 questions from our listeners, and we will be answering them quick fire, to give you all the knowledge that you feel that you're not getting from the regular episodes of the podcast. If you do have a question, you can either go on LinkedIn, go on the Thinking Commercially group, and type into any of the posts. You can comment on any of the posts. You can contact us on Instagram through the Thinking Commercially page, or alternatively, you can email me, which is ben.triggs@brightnetwork.co.uk, with your questions, and we'll get those answered at some point in late May. Chris, thank you very much for your time again this week. Super interesting as always. And I'll speak to you soon.
Great stuff, Ben. Thank you very much.
What a fantastic episode. I hope you got lots out of it at home. And remember, head to our LinkedIn, head to our Instagram for all the information around the podcast. Plus, make sure you get your questions in for the May episode. Until then, have a great month.